you lead us in a prayer and then we'll start our class?
All right. Let's pray. Our most high God and Father, thank you so much that we're able to come together in this place this morning. Thank you for Philip being with us, and thank you for the blessing of us finding him and his agreeing to come to work full time with us soon. And ask you to help everything go smoothly for that as he makes the transition, he and Lori, and ask you to help his work here to go well, not only today, but as he begins here. And ask you to bless us as your disciples as we're sitting here today and we're learning more about you from your word. Help us to be edified and that you're glorified, Father. Thank you for the forgiveness of sins that you have extended your arm to us in blessing to us, even though we're not worthy of it, Father, and ask you to help us not to sin and to walk in the light because you're in the light. And we ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. So you're studying the miracles, and I just said I'll just take the ones that are coming up, and I think this may be in a different place on your list that you were provided with by Rick, but I was supposed to be here in September, and because of my dad's decline, and it was really close before his death, I had to cancel. So I think this was moved up or something, I'm not sure. But when Rick sent me this topic, he sort of took me back. He sent me, he said, well, the next one is the miracles of the crucifixion. And I stopped for a second, and I was really just befuddled by it. And I thought, Jesus didn't do any miracles at the crucifixion. Because I know you've been studying the miracles of Jesus. Because when I was here, I did the deaf man and things like that. And then I thought, oh, there are miracles connected to the crucifixion. There are miracles surrounding the crucifixion. And I thought, yeah, that'd be a really interesting class to have. And that sensation I had, that response I had to think of, well, Jesus didn't do any miracles at the crucifixion. I sort of set that thought aside. And then as I prepared this lesson, when I got down toward the end, I thought, that's a good place to stop. So we'll come back to that here in just a few minutes. So we're going to look at Matthew's account. So turn with me to Matthew chapter 27. There are four events associated with the crucifixion of Jesus that are very unusual events that we're classifying here as miracles. John does not mention any of these. Not unusual. John's gospel is of a different kind of purpose and different content. Mark and Luke mention two of them. Matthew mentions all four. So we're going to focus on Matthew. We'll go over and look at Luke quickly. But we're going to focus on Matthew. So I want you to read, let's read together Matthew 27, verses 45 to 56. And Hilton, will you read that for us? Matthew 27, 45 to 56.
Now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Some of those who stood there, when they heard that, said, this man is calling for Elijah. Immediately one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and offered it to him to drink. The rest said, let him alone, let us see if Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked and the rocks were split. The graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to men. Where do you want me to stop?
To 56, please.
Okay. Let me take this off. I'm getting cloudy.
Yeah, I know that sensation.
And many of the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly, this was the Son of God." And many women who followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, were there looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Jose, and the mother of Zebedee's son.
All right, thank you so much. So you have been studying for quite a while about the miracles of Jesus. And it may be, not knowing everything that you've covered or what every teacher has covered, it may be that you've actually had some dedicated time defining a miracle. But even if you haven't, if you've just been reading and studying these miracles, then that by itself creates in your mind a definition of a miracle. And even though people will use that expression fairly loosely, like, my team won the Super Bowl, it's a miracle, something like that, you know. It's a real stretch, right? So let's lay out, first of all, because I think it's helpful here in this text. What's the biblical definition of a miracle?
Supernatural.
Supernatural, meaning something that does not naturally occur. It snows. That's not a miracle, right? Snow happens. Wind. People get sicknesses, diseases, death. People get well from sicknesses. Sometimes antibodies kick in, or maybe there's some medicine applied. Those are not miraculous deeds, are they? Going fast in a car to someone 500 years ago, that might look very supernatural. My grandmother, born in 1908, described for me the first time she saw a car. Scared her so badly she went and hid. She was a little girl. But we understand it's not a miracle. An automobile is not a miracle. So it is something supernatural. Let's add to that. What else would you say? Stack on that definition.
Extraordinary.
Okay. Beyond what's ordinary, extraordinary. It's not something you see on any kind of regular basis. Not something you expect to see. Or
defies natural law.
Yeah, it's against natural law, gravity, you know, the aging process of the body. The body begins to decay, you know, like the Lazarus miracle. He's been in the grave so many days, he's going to be stinking because the decay. So that's a natural process. So this is reversing that. It's against the natural process. Yes, Ray.
The reaction to it is amazement and wonder.
Yeah. Yeah. The reaction reflects that it's extraordinary, that it's supernatural. Because people haven't seen that. Exactly right. And of course, what force is behind a miracle based on your definitions?
God
is. So it's God acting, not humans acting. Humans can do extraordinary things. You see some people play a musical instrument. You see some athletes perform. And you see that they're doing something extraordinary, but it's still within the human domain, the human realm. We're talking about something in the realm of the divine. Only God can do that. And so, would you say that after having read the Matthew 27 events here, 45 to 56, would you say that these four things, the darkness from noon to 3 o'clock, the temple torn in two, evidently just all of a sudden from top to bottom, the earthquake happening when it did, okay, and the resurrection of the saints, would you say that they would fall into that category? Definitely the first two, okay? The darkness in the middle of the day, although we understand that an eclipse can occur. But when you read this text, the way it's presented in Matthew, this is all around the event of the death of Jesus. That these are not happening coincidentally or just haphazardly as nature sort of does things and it cycles, you know, pressure from underneath the earth's, you know, in the crust, and it has to come out, and it pushes up the plates, and you have an earthquake, that kind of thing. That happens every now and then. That's a natural phenomenon, but it's the timing that's so miraculous here. The earthquake, the rock splitting, the temple torn at this moment in time kind of thing. And so I think they do fall into that category, and especially as we look at the purpose of these things. So I want to say four things about these four miracles, first of all. And that is, again, I want to remind you, there are no miracles performed by Jesus at this crucifixion event. He's not healing someone of a disease miraculously. He's not turning water into wine. He's not walking on water. He's not resurrecting someone from the dead. The day of the crucifixion, obviously. Now we know his resurrection is a miracle. And that these are events on display before all. We, I think, noted this last month when I was here. Some miracles were very private, weren't they? Jesus goes to some lengths to make some of them private. Others are not. Feeding of the 5,000, it's a very public thing. These definitely are in the category of public. They're on display here. And third of all, that thing that I was just mentioning, which explains the miraculous element, is the timing. They're all within a few hours of each other, but three are seemingly simultaneous at the point of his death. So the darkness had existed for 3 hours, from noon to 3 o'clock. So at the sixth hour to the ninth hour. So according to Jewish time reckoning and the way people wrote about timekeeping at this time, which is a lot more crude than the way we keep time today, 6 hour means it's noon, roughly noon, midday, and then 3 o'clock, 3 hours later. But the other three things, at the end of that 3 hour period, the earthquaking, the temple torn, and the resurrection of dead people. The fourth thing I want you to see before we begin to look at these individually is that these are literal events, but they're also symbolic. I'm not saying this is merely symbolism that Matthew is writing about, that the earth shook because this was a momentous event. No, I believe that Matthew is writing the earth shook. However, all of these have a message to them. You know, the feeding of the 5,000 we mentioned a while ago was something that's presented in the Gospels as actually happening. But in John's Gospel, right after that, Jesus has a huge discourse the next day on the bread of life. You know, he's bouncing off that miracle, isn't he? To make points about how that he is the true bread. You're seeking the bread you got yesterday, that today you're hungry again. I'm offering the bread that comes down from heaven. I am the bread of life. So he's using that miracle there that was literal, now with symbolically, with a message behind it. So note that as we look at these. Let's talk about the darkness for 3 hours in the middle of the day. Go over to Luke with me. This is the one time that we'll go over and look in Luke. And I think this is interesting how Luke phrases this here. And I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Earl, won't you read that for us? Luke 23, verse 44 and 45. Luke 23, 44, 45.
And it was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, while the sun's light failed, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two.
Okay, like Matthew's account, and like Mark's account, Matthew and Mark have the darkness and the torn curtain in the temple. They don't have the earthquake and the resurrection. Only Matthew has that. But here in Luke's gospel, when he talks about the darkness, Luke injects another phrase to further describe the situation. Matthew just says it was dark. Luke says that plus what else? Over all the earth. Sun's light failed. Okay? While the sun's light failed. I've never known the sun's light to fail. There's that miraculous element. You know, I'm sure naturalists would want to say, oh, this is all symbolic in Luke and Matthew and Mark, and it was really an eclipse, you know, that kind of thing. Did God move a heavenly, like the moon in front of the sun or something like that? We have no idea. Or did the sun just stop to shine? We don't know the details of this. But it's interesting how this is put. It's not just that there was darkness, but it says the sun's light failed. Light failed. It's interesting. Because while we're in Luke 23, Earl, while you're there, just help us out here again. Look over in Luke 22, which was right before the crucifixion and the trials and the arrest of Jesus, which actually during those incidents, it's during the arrest. Look what Luke writes in Luke 22, verse 53. Go ahead, Earl. This is Jesus when he's being arrested.
While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this hour and the, but this hour and the power of darkness are yours.
Okay. Jesus says, in broad daylight, day to day, I've been teaching in the temple. You didn't come and get me. See, they're coming to arrest him at night. They even try him at night. They're doing this because they're trying to do this so that the next morning they can present him as a guilty man before the mob, the people. But there's symbolism in this too. They're doing this at night. They're doing this in the dark. And Jesus ties it to that. He says, I've been teaching in the daylight. You've come to give me in the dark. And now is the hour of darkness. In other words, darkness, and he's using it symbolically here, darkness is going to have its hour. Darkness is going to have its moment. But just its hour. And it doesn't mean 60 minutes. It means its point in time, its moment. So Jesus himself says this. So understand something. It looks as though, and this is to the apostles' eyes, that things are unraveling with Jesus. That things are happening beyond his control. No. He's going to be taken. He's going to be manhandled. He's going to be beaten and slapped and spat upon. And then they're going to really go to work on him. That's just the start. But none of this has taken Jesus by surprise. Darkness is being allowed to have its moment. And at the peak of that moment, when darkness is accomplishing its darkest task, and that is eking the life out of Jesus, the sun stops shining. So let's think about this darkness and light, day and night kind of thing. What does the Bible tell us? Just real simple things here. What does the Bible tell us about creation and light? Where's light in the creation account in Genesis? At the very beginning, let there be light. You know, we conclude a lot of things from that. We understand that sunlight is necessary for life. So before you have plants and animals and things like that, and we sort of conclude that, and I guess that's fine and that's good. But light is the first thing here that's created for this existence here that humans have. Light is at the very beginning. And symbolically through the Bible, what kind of correlation is there between God, his character, his being, and light?
Same.
So
it's right. It's one of those descriptions to describe God. God is light. God gives light. If you don't have God, you don't have light.
He's the giver of life.
Life and light are used a lot together in the same texts.
James says he's the father of light.
He's the father of lights. I mean, it's just all over the place, cover to cover, isn't it? And cover to cover, what correlation is there between sin and evil and darkness? What does the Bible say over and over?
Men love the darkness.
Sinful men love the darkness. Excellent. When does sin and evil do its work? Symbolically. We know people can sin in the light of day. Okay? And you cannot sin at night. But night and darkness is symbolic of when people do their deeds. And it's the idea of, you know, their shameful things. And they're trying to be, you know, covered up and those kinds of things. So when you have light, biblically you think of God. When you have darkness, you biblically think of God, of when you have darkness, you biblically think of Satan and sin and evil and wickedness and all those kinds of things. And here in Luke 22, Jesus says, at the beginning of this thing, he's arrested, he's tried multiple times, Jews and Romans, and then he's, you know, beaten and tortured, and then he's taken to the cross, and that ordeal, that starts there with the arrest. And at the beginning of that, Jesus says, darkness has its hour. And then at the, I guess you could say, I almost want to say peak, but I guess you could say at the very pit of darkness having its hour. And can you think of a more wicked 24 hours? It's not even 24 hours, it's about 20 hours. Can you think of a more, can you think of a darker 20 hours in human history? Can. And when it's coming down to its end there, literally the earth is darkened. That's all reflective, isn't it? But again, Jesus says darkness is going to have its hour. And that, in a way, you could say, well, who's going to win out? Darkness or light? So if you go and hit a couple of passages, and let's do that. John 8, verse 12. Les, will you read that for us? John 8, verse 12. And then, Rachel, could you read Colossians 1? Would you mind reading? Colossians 1, 13. And let's read these in a row here in just a second. And then Zach, have you here when I say so, read Ephesians 5, verse 8. Ephesians 5, 8. So let's look at these three passages and see what they say. All right, what does Jesus say in John 8 there, Les?
And Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life.
How pervasive is the light of Jesus? Light of what? The world. Like, this is the light in this area right here. You know, if it's nighttime out there, it won't light up that front lawn and show that bear out there again. I heard about it, okay? I've not changed my mind. Just want y'all to know that didn't scare me off, okay? But anyway, I'm not scared of the literal bears, okay? I'm more scared of the spiritual bears, okay? So that's what we got to be aware of, right? You know, fighting against evil forces, not bears. So, and that's what we'll do together. But that's so limited, isn't it? Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. We know what the light of the world is. It's the sun. It was put in place in Genesis 1. But Jesus is talking about a different kind of light. He's talking about spiritual light. Look what the Apostle Paul writes about what has happened to Christians. Colossians 1:13, please. Translated us from darkness to the kingdom of the Son. And who's the Son? He's the light of the world. And then look at these instructions in Ephesians 5 verse 8.
For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light.
Darkness had its hour. And here's the great irony. And I'm not so sure even if Satan understood all this. Have you ever thought about this? Satan actually pulls off the deed to have these people orchestrate the death of Jesus. I mean, you think about all the Judas is tempted, you know, with the money. Pilate's tempted to violate his principles, to give in to political pressure. The Jewish leadership, they're enticed by their envy toward Jesus. And so you got all this, all these sins that people are tempted to commit that all come together to spell the death of Jesus. But in the very death of Jesus, when darkness does its thing, it's that very deed that Jesus will use to bring light to everyone who wants it. It's his death, which was the great deed of darkness that will actually bring light. His death will make it possible for us to go from darkness to light. So darkness has its hour, which means it's going to triumph, but it's going to be a very short-lived victory. But even beyond that, the very thing that they thought led to their victory is going to lead to their defeat, the forces of darkness. Because Jesus is going to resurrect and he's going to offer salvation through his death. All right, we'll build on that. Let's look at the next one. The temple curtain. What was this object? What was its purpose? Where was it?
Separated from the holy place.
That's right. Separated a holy place from the most holy place. What else do you want to say? So the most holy place, what was in there in the temple? Ark of the Covenant. Inside the Ark were the commandments, and at different times, different other little items from their history. But basically the Ark of the Covenant, and on top of the Ark was the mercy seat, where among the Israelite people, the presence of God was supposed to dwell. We understand not literally, as Isaiah writes, the earth is his footstool, heaven's his throne. But what was the only function of that little inner chamber, the holy place, the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies? It was only once a year. What was it? So the high priest went in there and sprinkled blood on the mercy seat on the Day of Atonement for the sins of Israel. Only the high priest could go in there, only once a year. That was, on earth, the representation of how close you could get to God. One man, once a year, with blood to offer for the atonement of the people. At the moment of Jesus' death, and there would be some priests milling about, about to approach some ceremonies they would do just outside the temple and just in the holy place, not the Holy of Holies. Not that time of the year. But there would be priests about. And probably with them on the outside, some Levites about. When all of a sudden, from the top, the curtain was torn. And it says torn. It didn't say it collapsed. You know, like the rod that was holding it or the collapse that were holding it somehow gave way because they were aged and rotted or something. No, it was torn. That's a verb. It's like taking a piece of paper. Like that. And torn from top to the bottom. And torn right in two pieces. It didn't just fall and somehow a little bit of it got ripped. It was torn, just like you, like a piece of paper. Again, you really think about this, and that thing was thick and tall. It would, a human couldn't do that. Even if they got it down on the floor, a human couldn't like that. Couldn't do it. Torn in two. Well, in a way, this may be the most obvious symbolism, right? Look over in Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews 10, starting in verse 19. Brother Frank, do you have that? Hebrews 10, 19 to 22, please.
Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water.
All right. What does this text do for us in how we look at the event of the torn curtain in the temple? What does this symbolize?
Access to God.
Access to God. Only the priest once a year had access to the presence of God over the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. Now that curtain is just torn. The door is just busted wide open. And who's made the way according to Hebrews 10 here? Jesus. And with what did he make a way to God, this access to God? By his what?
Flesh.
By his, yes, his flesh was offered, and also right before that, by his blood. He dies. And the very death of Jesus opened up access to God from that point on like they've never been in human experience. We don't have a high priest that comes from among men. We have the very Son of God who is our priest, who takes us before the mercy seat of God. And this temple curtain tearing at the point of his death is symbolic that that old system and that old covenant has now been replaced by a better way, which is the whole book of Hebrews, by the way. And think about this. There were two groups, and I want to say political operatives, really, who usually were at odds with each other, who coordinated to do Jesus in. And that's the chief priests, who wanted to keep peace with the Romans because they had a lot of political power. And they saw Jesus as a threat to the whole system they had working, and they were fearful the Romans would come in and shut things down, which they do in AD 70. And then you have the scribes, who were the scholars among the Pharisees, who had control of people through their oral traditions. Those two butted heads all the time, those two groups. But they coordinate with each other to have Jesus arrested, falsely accused, tried, brought before Pilate, and pressured him to put him to death. I wonder what they thought. You know they got word that in the temple, the curtain was torn. It didn't just collapse. It was just like that. I wonder how that set with them. When they knew that around the third hour, when Jesus finally expired, that curtain was torn. So what a strong message here, that the death of Jesus is now opening up new life. Let's look at the other two. These are deep and profound. The earthquake. And how severe was this earthquake? What's the additional description in most texts? It is Matthew. The rock split. I lived for a couple years in California, never experienced an earthquake or a tremor. One time there was one out there when I was living there. I was back east visiting. But I was on a ladder up in Northern Virginia, and we had an earthquake. It actually was centered in Northern Virginia, south of where I was at. But I was actually on a ladder, and I felt this weird thing. And there was a rock quarry near where I live. And I thought, oh, they're setting off a blast. I was outside working on the fence. My wife calls about 10 minutes later and says, are you okay? Did you feel the earthquake? And I thought, oh, that's what that was. It was a tremor. This was so severe, the rock split. That's a big one. Don't have a Richter scale measurement here, but this is a big one. Because what we see like on the West Coast and some other places is just a shift in the plates. This is significant, okay? And look what it represents. You ever heard the expression, you know, something happens and you say, well, that was an earth-shaking event. That's all symbolic, right? It's just figurative language. Well, this is not figurative. It happened, but it is symbolic. The earth shook when Jesus died. The earth shook. I'm just going to refer to this because time. Hebrews 12 was the text I was going to have you turn to, which describes in Hebrews 12, 25 to 29, about at the moment when Moses was up on the mountain, or that he was about to go up on the mountain, and what was Mount Sinai doing right before they got the covenant? You remember? It was quaking, trembling, smoke. It scared the Israelites. That's why they said, you go up on the mountain. We're scared of this God. And Hebrews 12, 25 to 29 talks about we're receiving a kingdom now that cannot be shaken. The earth can be shaken, as big as it is. It was proven that day Jesus died. But the text in Colossians 1, verse 13 that Rachel read one moment ago said, he has translated us from darkness into the kingdom of his dear Son. And Hebrews chapter 12 says that kingdom cannot be shaken. The earth can be shaken, but not Jesus' kingdom. It's a scary moment. And you've heard, I don't know, has anybody here been in an earthquake, by the way? I talked about my little experience. Somebody, you've been in one? What was it like? Is it scary?
Well, Daddy, my father was in the service, and we lived in the Azores.
Okay, and
so there's a plate there.
Islands.
Often I would come home from playing, and my mother would say, did you feel the earthquake? Well, I was a kid, so it wasn't scary to me.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Another a tremor deal.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this is huge. The earth shook. The ground, the stability under the people was rocked. But Christ is bringing in a kingdom that cannot be. Yeah, right.
We did have a tremor here about a month ago.
Oh, here in North Carolina.
Now I know you have the bear, but I have the tremor.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, I actually felt one.
I'm still coming. Sorry. But my books are here. My wife is up there. So I'm torn, but I'm going to go back and get her. But give me another few weeks. So, but they do happen everywhere, really. They're more common than you think they are, and not just California. But we're talking about something that was significant here. And this prompted the centurion, the Roman commander who's overseeing the execution. It prompts him to do what? When he saw these things, what did he do? He didn't see the temple torn, the curtain torn, right? But
surely this is the Son of God.
All right. Translation's a little iffy there. Does he mean the Son of God, like you and I would think of, as in the Gospel of John, the Son of God? Or is it that he means a Son of God, and being a true Roman pagan, he believes in many gods? Somehow or another, and over in Mark's Gospel, he makes the comment, I think it's Mark's, that this must have been an innocent man. And that probably is reflective of everything he'd seen, Jesus' demeanor and everything else. But we don't know what exactly where this man's thinking was about Jesus. Has he become a disciple of Christ and that kind of thing? We don't know anything like that. But this was significant enough for this man to recognize that Jesus, I'm going to use your word, was extraordinary. That this moment was extraordinary. And he doesn't have all the things that we have, like all the prophecies and all the other accounts of who Jesus was and what he did. But just that moment, this centurion who was overseeing the execution, who was no friend of Jesus, by the way, right? Was moved to conclude, Son of God, a son of a God, whatever, this is extraordinary. Exclamation point, isn't it? And then look at the fourth miracle, which was a resurrection. It says that the saints, that expression is commonly used of Christians in the epistles. It's also commonly used of faithful people of God in the Old Testament. The Psalms in several places refer to God's people as saints. The resurrection of the dead. And it appears in Matthew that it says they came to life, but then they don't actually go into the city until his resurrection. What it appears to say that, okay, there. And I don't think that's a big deal to get hung up on. But they do go into the city and they appear to many. And they would have appeared to people they knew. So if some kind of guy comes down the street, I don't know if I don't know him. I don't know if he's been dead in his life. I don't know whether he's suffered death before, if he's a stranger. But if it's somebody I knew that had died, then I see the significance of that. And that's the communication here. They appear to many. It's resurrection appearances. Just like Jesus will have resurrection appearances after he raises from the dead. In other words, to people who know that he was dead, now he's alive. So this is presented to these witnesses as miracles. And this is again, it's such a flip. I don't know anything about martial arts, but and there might be, you tread into some subject and there's some expert. And you don't know there's an expert here, so. But from what I understand, judo, does anybody know judo here? I mean, with bears around, it's good to know if there's somebody with judo skills, but from what I understand about judo, the angle of judo is that you actually use your opponent's attack against them. That when they come at you, you use their momentum to flip them or do something with them. It's exactly what Jesus does to Satan. Jesus takes Satan's deadliest blow and flips it against him. You're trying to destroy me, but I'm going to use my death to give life. And here it's immediately symbolized at the point of him dying, some godly, faithful people who had died came to life. And they literally came to life, but it's symbolic that in Jesus' death, there's life. Man, that's powerful, isn't it? Is that a warning bell or the bell? That is the bell. So, one last point. You know, we want to see God do big things, don't we? Obvious things. Sometimes God's too subtle for us. Well, here he does big things. 3,000 people, 49 days later, become Christians, preaching of the gospel at Pentecost. But you know, that doesn't sum up everybody that was in Jerusalem for that feast. And in the book of Acts, those scribes and chief priests continue to work against Christ's people. These are incredible events, but you know what they are? They're complementary. They're almost like the sideshow. You know what the great deed was that day, in spite of how incredible these other ones are? The great deed that day was not a miracle. It was a miracle that God was in human flesh. But once in human flesh, what the Son of God did was suffer the thing that is the most humbling thing that spells the most hopeless point of a human's life, the moment they die. It's the most humbling thing. It's the most helpless they'll ever be. Jesus experiences that and absorbs it. And in that, he pays for our sin. The greatest thing that God's ever done was allow his Son to be in a human body and to suffer this death. As impressive as these other things are, that's where the real power of the gospel is. It's in the death of Jesus. And I think even that these events, as impressive as they are, they just amplify that. Okay, thank you so much for your participation.